You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Quad Cities NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson. And as listeners to this show know, a major focus I've had over the years is our current partisan divide. Many guests have appeared to help explain our current state of politics, and one of the key areas of exploration is, to paraphrase the talking heads, well, how did we get here? My guest today is author of a book that provides some clues from an unlikely place or period of time to answer that question. He's John Gans, and the book is called When the Clock Broke, Con Men, Conspiracists, and How America Cracked Up in the Early 1990s. This book is featured as one of 2024's best on many year-end lists and reviews, and that's why I'm very happy to welcome John as my guest today. John, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
I the 1990s, I look back and it seemed like a decent decade, maybe in the latter part, but the way things stood, and you do an excellent job of going through this. If we could take ourselves back, the Soviet Union had dissolved. We had won the first Gulf War. Things were going pretty good, but underneath the surface, there were some things boiling up. What exactly was going on there that led to this really kind of interesting decade that I think you can see traces of what's going on now back then?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, as you said, the 90s, especially the latter half of the decade, are remembered by most Americans as a pretty good time, as kind of golden era and maybe a time we'd like to return to. At the beginning of the decade, it was much more uncertain. Americans were not feeling great about where the country was going. Part of that is because the country was in a nasty little recession, which wasn't quite as bad as what we saw in 2007, 2008, but was kind of a mini dry run of it, in the sense that it saw the failure of a lot of financial institutions, and it saw the disappearance of a lot of different kinds of jobs. There was a wave of deindustrialization. There was a certain type of banking and the savings and loans crisis that made people very angry at the interrelationship between politics and business. So you get these hints of these sorts of things. And of course, you have the end of the Cold War, which makes we don't have a common enemy anymore. There's lots of poverty in the inner cities. There's crime. You have one of the worst episodes of civil disorder in the United States after, some people say it was the worst riot since the draft riots of the Civil War and the Rodney King riots in Los Angeles. And if you go back and read the newspaper and watch TV and listen to candidates at that time, there's a sense that the country might fall apart. A few years later, you go forward and all the problems seem to be solved. In my view, perhaps they were papered over, not solved. But that was sort of the situation around 1989 to 1993, which is mostly when my book takes place.
We keep looking right now at so many norms have been broken. It's not new, and one of the first topics in your book is David Duke. And for listeners who may not remember that name, his showing in election was really kind of a harbinger of things to come. If you could give a little background and talk about the impact of Duke's rise.
Absolutely. Well, David Duke was a grand wizard of the Ku Klux Klan and a neo-Nazi. He was a perennial candidate for office in Louisiana, where he was from. And he ran several he became a state legislator over the attempt of the Republican Party, both locally and nationally, to stop him. But they could not. His primary voters really wanted him. And then he ran for governor, and he gets blown out. You know, because there's a significant black vote in Louisiana that was not looking forward to having a Klansman as governor, and the business community rallied against him, thinking he would hurt the state. There was a big revulsion of him, but he gets 55% of the white vote. And a lot of people are watching his candidacy as a kind of harbinger or bellwether, a signal that a new kind of politics was maybe emerging. But it's very interesting, from my perspective, going back to that race and just seeing how much the Republicans threw at him. Ronald Reagan did radio ads against him. George H.W. Bush denounced him. The RNC sent people down to help out with his opponents. None of it seemed to matter. He really had the hearts and minds of Republican voters. And he wasn't running exactly on the unalloyed program of Nazism or Klan ideology. He had kind of a softened version of that. And people seemed to be, although it was pretty transparently untrue, people seemed to be buying it. But then many others in the country who shared his extreme politics, but maybe thought they could package it in a more attractive way, saw his race and thought it was their signal to go forward.
You know, what I thought was always interesting about that race is when I first read about David Duke, I assumed he might be coming from rural Louisiana, but his district was actually in the suburbs. And correct me if I'm wrong, that's a well-to-do area.
Metairie, Louisiana, is right outside of New Orleans as a suburb. It's a sort of a bedroom community of New Orleans. It's interesting. It's a bit of a white flight suburb, as they used to call them. It is mixed. There is a well-to-do part of the suburb, which was the kind of controlled by the Republicans, a group, you know, were literally country club Republicans. They had their stronghold in the Metairie Country Club. But there were a lot of blue collar and lower middle class white Democrats in Metairie who were, you know, may have voted for Ronald Reagan, but had not changed their voter registration yet over to Republican. That level of realignment had not happened. And the times in Louisiana during the 1980s had been very tough on people like this. The oil industry crashed. A lot of the lower level engineering or labor jobs that would have been, you know, that this group of that this class of people would have had were disappearing. The kind of generous populism of Louisiana, which created a lot of jobs in state institutions, were going away because there wasn't the money to support them. And they felt, you know, very alienated from a Republican Party that they thought was mostly for rich people, and also did not feel attached any longer to the Democrats, which had become a multiracial party and the party of civil rights. They also were very attached to certain populist laws that, you know, helped them to not pay property taxes if you had a modest house. And Duke recognizes all this, understands how to reach out to this alienated constituency, and basically, you know, uses them as a wrecking ball against the establishment of the Republican Party.
It's interesting how you draw a line between some of the key political figures in this era, from Duke. Then we go to kind of Pat Buchanan, and his insurgent campaign in the Republican Party, which seemed to pick up many of those messages.
He saw, very explicitly saw Duke as an opening and thought, okay, this might be my moment. Now, Pat Buchanan, of course, your listeners probably know, very famous figure in both the conservative movement and the Republican Party, had high-ranking positions in two Republican White Houses, in Nixon's White House and Reagan's White House, was a talking head on television for many years, a syndicated columnist for many years, was sort of, I suppose you could say, the right flank of the Republican Party, always trying to be on the right flank of the Republican Party. He famously said, there's a great vacuum just to the right of Ronald Reagan, and I want to fill that. So, yes, he and many writers that he was close to, political writers and commentators he was close to, witnessed Duke's run and thought, much like Wallace, had influenced a change in the Republican Party in Nixon's era. Duke was signaling the same kind of realignment or change or shift in politics. And he launches an insurgent kind of protest candidacy against George H.W. Bush, who, we should remember, was not a conservative as such. He moved to the right for sure, but was never really part of that movement and was not trusted by the American right. He was too much of a Rockefeller Republican, a moderate, a country club Republican. Whether or not that characterization is fair is one thing. That's the way he was viewed. Buchanan has, you know, is not winning primaries, but he's showing that there's a large number of Republican voters who are very dissatisfied with the leadership of the Republican Party under George H.W. Bush. And his candidacy, much like Gene McCarthy's against LBJ, wounds, damages George H.W. Bush's standings. Of course, H.W. doesn't pull out, but it's clear his political position is not very strong.
He used issues like, again, with echoes today, very much anti-trade, and anti-immigration.
Yes, which were two issues that Republicans then were you know, much, I don't know if it's the left, but closer to the center than they were today. Of course, Reagan was a great believer in free trade, as was Pat Buchanan until his kind of conversion to this protectionist politics. Reagan famously signed an amnesty for illegal immigrants. And, you know, he indulged in the rhetoric that became familiar in American politics about America becoming being a city on a hill, a beacon for the world, a place that welcomed immigrants and wanted them to come and be a part of the, you know, and join the American way. Buchanan's attitude of what the nature of America was much different. America for Buchanan was made up of white Europeans. It was not an idea, a set of propositions. It was a historical civilization, if you will, that was made up of the particular historical experiences of this type of Americans who he thought should be preeminent in the country. Now, it's slightly ironic to go and think today that, you know, Buchanan was very afraid that, you know, Latino immigrants would make his kind of America disappear. Of course, now, you know, that voting bloc put this kind of anti-immigration, anti-free trade politics over the top. It's just a little irony of history that I'm not sure he appreciates, but I certainly do.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and I'm very pleased to have as my guest today John Gans, who's authored a book that some of you may heard of out there. I think many of you have, When the Clock Broke, Con Men, Conspiracists, and How America Cracked Up in the Early 1990s. The reason you've heard about it, if you haven't read it, is because it's showing up on a lot of year-end lists as one of the best books of the year. And that's why I'm very pleased to have John here. We've been touching on some early themes of the book. There's a lot here. I'm not going to get to it all, unfortunately, but I want to pick out some things that I noticed here, too. An Iowa connection here with Randy and Ruby Ridge. If you could kind of tell that story, the beginnings and the tragic end, so to speak.
Well, of course, you know, that story ends up in the west of the country, in the Idaho Panhandle. But it begins in Iowa. And it begins really during the farm crisis in Iowa, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners remember as very hard times. This part of the country suffered a kind of mini depression. Conditions in many places were just as bad as the depression. Now, we think of poverty in the inner cities, but many rural areas saw similar conditions. Along with the decline in the family farm, there was a deindustrialization going on because there's no market for farm implements. There's lots of jobs being lost. And Randy Weaver, who comes from a very conventional family, in Iowa, finds himself trying to make sense of the world that seems to be falling apart. And he gets kind of sucked into a whole universe of conspiracy theories that drag him farther and farther to the extreme right. And eventually he leaves Iowa with his family. He moves to way out to the Selkirk Mountains, a kind of tributary range of the Rockies in Idaho. And he sets up a cabin with no electricity, no running water, to be away from a federal government that he believes is, you know, controlled by malign forces. He gets involved and arguably entrapped by federal agents who are looking for right-wing extremist terrorists, neo-Nazi terrorists in that region after a wave of attacks that happened in the 1980s. He refuses to appear in court. A warrant is issued for his arrest. And this becomes a matter of, it's not a very big deal. It's one guy holding out in the middle of nowhere. But the media picks it up. It becomes an embarrassment for the FBI and the Department of Justice. And they throw a lot at trying to get this guy. And a tragedy ensues where they really threw overkill at him. And they ended up, you know, playing out his fantasy exactly, which was that there was an overbearing, tyrannical federal government that was trying to harm his family. And they did. They killed one of his sons. They killed his wife. And this moment, and he held out before negotiating his surrender to the feds. This moment became a huge rallying event for the far right. And it made their theory of the case, which was that middle Americans were at risk of being the targets of federal government tyranny, look really convincing. And that, so that's the story of the Weavers, which is, yes, very much rooted in the real hard times that Iowa experienced in that era. I will say, though, and I don't get to talk about in this book because I focus mostly on this type of politics, but, you know, that's a minor strain. I'm sure a lot of people also remember Farm Aid, which is a much more hopeful and inclusive form of politics that came out of that, which was really politically much stronger and had a much more mass following than Weaver, who was alone, some would say not. But, you know, when you look at what happens a few years later, with the response to what happened in Waco and then with Timothy McVeigh in Oklahoma City, Weaver and Ruby Ridge really began a movement.
John, did you, as I was reading this book, I kept going, I mean, my whole time reading this was seeing links to today's politics and today's culture and today's society. When you set out to write this, was that your intent?
Yes. I have to say, yes. I thought it was. So what happened was, when I was beginning to do research for what eventually became this book, I found an essay or in a newsletter by a libertarian economist, Murray Rothbard, from 1992 called Right Wing Populism. And it sounded like an eerie prophecy of Trump, the type of leadership, the type of rousing, ideological, charismatic leadership that attacked media elites. And I just thought, oh my God, this is the whole thing. So when I began to look at that era, I started to see more and more parallels. And I didn't want to beat the reader on the head with it and tell them every time there's a parallel. I wanted to, you know, I trusted the intelligence of the readers to figure these things out and see them for themselves. And you have a lot of other things that are not even explicitly political. But, you know, there's a lot of talk right now about a very fragmented media environment, right? And the end of traditional media. Well, you get little hints of that, too. You had the rise of talk radio. You have the rise of a lot of angry voices on talk radio. You had a lot of TV talk shows that are showing a country that feels very lonely, dispossessed, angry, alienated, and don't feel represented by the old institutions, or, you know, not in the newspapers and not at the network TV, but maybe on cable or maybe on a daytime talk show or maybe calling in angry to a radio talk show. So yeah, there were many, many parallels that kept jumping out to me, and I thought it was really remarkable. And yeah, there was a, it was a, in a similar way, it was a country that really seemed for this moment to be very confused about its way forward and mostly experiencing things through anger and through a sense of loss.
Yeah, one of the best aspects of this book is that you did not hit people over the head with the parallels. I like that. I
Thank
mean,
you.
you didn't need to. It was
Thank
there.
you.
And again, for me, I'm seeing this and I'm going, oh, there's a direct line here. One other part here that I thought was really interesting. It's hard to pick the best part of the book because there's several, multiple aspects of it. But I again, for folks young enough, they might not remember the name, but for people my age, we do. That's John Gotti. And a
Oh,
couple
yeah.
of themes that come up here that you said, if I could just, the open embrace of corruption and criminality rather than its rejection, that's got
Yeah.
parallels today. And
Yeah.
discontent with the distribution of wealth and power fostered closer public identification with certain types of capitalism and capitalists. All this is playing out here, and you've got
Yeah.
this trial of Gotti, which, if you could talk about a little bit, and for again, our listeners who may be too young, don't know
Sure.
the roots
I'll
of.
exp I would be happy to explain. This is one of my favorite parts of the book and favorite parts to research and write. I'm a New Yorker, so I had some vague memory of this, but we New Yorkers have perhaps an unhealthy fondness for characters like this. So John Gotti was the head of the Gambino family, one of the famous five families, but he was also a very public figure. He was a media darling. He was a character who appeared in the tabloids on TV. He was very charismatic. He wore fancy suits. And the feds really couldn't get him. They called him Teflon Don because they kept on throwing criminal cases at him. And, through criminal activity like bribing or threatening jurors, he would get off. And he became a folk hero for his ability to escape these efforts of the feds. And a lot of New Yorkers looked up to him as a emblem of an old way of doing things, as a smart and realistic way of being, and as just a kind of sharp fella. And yeah, so he becomes a tabloid star. They eventually are able to convict him, and at his sentencing, there's a riot. 1,000 people come down to the federal courthouse in Brooklyn, or come up as the case may be from lower parts of Queens and Brooklyn, and try to basically riot at the courthouse. I don't know if they were planning on busting him out of jail, but they were yelling down with the government. It became a political thing, and I think that what Gotti represented to me, and I think is something that's really relevant today, was in a city that felt like social order was going out the window, people didn't view Gotti as just yet another criminal who should be locked up, but as a potential protector, as an emblem of an older way of doing things that people remembered with fondness. Some people joked that he should be mayor. Some people complained that he was always very nice and kissing babies and saying hello to the people in the neighborhood and wasn't one of the real criminals. So this turning of Gotti into a celebrity with this nostalgic stuff around him and his belief that he wasn't really all that bad compared to other forms of crime and all that bad compared to maybe the criminals out on Wall Street or the criminals in government really kind of resonated with me, with another guy that we might know. When Trump was campaigning, there were a lot of people who had flags that depicted him as the Godfather. And I think it's a very similar energy to the people who kind of idolized John Gotti. Also, the mafia's big antagonist was Rudy Giuliani, who's another big part of that chapter. And I write about how during his run for mayor, he had to drop a little bit of his Mr. Clean, G-Man, Goody Two-Shoes act, maybe to appeal some voters who didn't really buy that kind of stuff. Not exactly drop it, say that he was not so tough on the mob anymore, but certain people he got close to, certain attitudes he struck, definitely were different than his times as a federal prosecutor, which didn't endear him to a lot of people in New York. So, yeah, I thought that chapter was just really, and looking at that era in New York City, the fear of crime, the feeling of exhaustion about corruption just was really enlightening for me personally.
And you had an ingenious way of ending the book that I'm not going to reveal. Listeners, okay. If you want to find out, go buy it. It's worth it. The whole book is worth it. But I thought it was a very ingenious way of ending the book that hits on these themes.
So
but I'm not going to go there.
Thank you so much.
So I got 5 questions left, but I got to just give you, because I got 2 minutes here.
Okay.
I'm going to stay with that theme. I got so many. If, listeners, if you want to find out why the name of the book, buy the book. You'll learn more about Ross Perot, Bill Clinton, a man named Sam Francis, who's one of those hidden figures of history that are very important that a lot of people may not have heard of. But yeah. I got to go back to the Godfather theme, and you talk about the difference between the Godfather and Goodfellas movies.
Oh, sure.
How does that play into this in about a minute and a half?
Sure. Okay. So basically, the Godfather 3 comes out around this time and Goodfellas comes around this time. Murray Rothbard, our old friend who wrote the Right Wing Populism essay, liked to review movies. And he thought that Goodfellas was a horrible depiction of a psychotic, crime infested society, unhealthy, that he basically associated with left liberalism. And he thought, look at all these left liberals who love Goodfellas, Scorsese's Goodfellas, and they don't like The Godfather. And he thought that The Godfather represented his vision of a patriarchal, conservative, capitalist society functioning basically as it should. Now, this ignores, of course, that The Godfather is a tragedy where, you know, the fight for power and wealth destroys this family and destroys their legacy. But he was very taken with The Godfather as a kind of myth of American capitalism, as a self-regulating system that didn't need the government, that had kind of old feudal aspects of it too. You know, these great houses that were passed from father to son. And he's very taken with the atmosphere of the movie. And, you know, I get it. We all love The Godfather. I don't think he was paying particular attention to how that movie ends, but that was basically his argument for the importance of that movie. In his buddy Sam Francis, who you mentioned, was also a big fan of The Godfather, similarly saw it as depicting a kind of old form of society that modern culture and capitalism were kind of degrading and corroding, but was a healthier way of doing things.
John Gans has been my guest today on Heartland Politics. He's the author of When the Clock Broke, Con Men, Conspiracists, and How America Cracked Up in the Early 1990s. If you like history, if you like politics, if you like culture, if you like a lot of things, if you just like a good book, go get it. John, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thank you so much. This was great.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.